Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series. The talk is entitled Humour and Pluralism, Kierkegaard on Religious Diversity, and is delivered by Professor George Connell.
Tonight we're very happy to welcome Professor George Connell of the Philosophy Department at Concordia College, United States. Professor Connell has his BA in philosophy and history from Mercer University and his MA and PhD in philosophy from Vanderbilt University. For 20 years he's been at Concordia College in the Department of Philosophy. Professor Connell specializes in the philosophy of Kierkegaard, and I hand over to him now because I think he wants to tell you about that.
Thanks for coming out tonight to hear the paper. I'm at the end of a four-month period here in Malta with a group of 15 American college students, and it seems that during that 4 months I performed almost every function other than the traditionally academic, so I'm happy to have a chance to share with you some of the work that I've done recently. I've noticed in my time here in Malta that the Maltese have a rich tradition of proverbs. I've had a fun time flipping through a collection of Maltese proverbs, and I think it gives me something of a glimpse into the wisdom of Malta to look at those statements. But there's a proverb I've heard in the U.S. that I think applies to this paper. When a man is carrying a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Is that one that's familiar in Malta as well? I think that applies in my case. As Paul said, over the years, most of my own scholarship has been in the field of Kierkegaard studies, and I periodically try to get away, escape, do something different. A few years ago, I was fortunate to be part of a Lutheran Academy of Scholars program. The Lutheran colleges in the U.S. are overwhelmingly undergraduate institutions without graduate programs, and it's the Lutheran Academy of Scholars gathers faculty from a variety of those colleges and takes them to Harvard for a couple of weeks to reinvigorate themselves. The project I chose to work on while I was at Harvard with this was the issue of religious diversity, what philosophers of religion had to offer on that topic. And this was my way of escaping Kierkegaard studies, but lo and behold, as I read into the topic, I thought, Kierkegaard has just the thing to say to help us think aright about that conflicted issue. So this is the paper that resulted. It really does build on work that I'd been doing in some previous years on Kierkegaard's theory of moods, and I'll be applying that to the topic of religious diversity. The handout that I've given you, it's primarily the quotations that I'll be reading from other people in the course of the paper, but I also lay out some of the key triads of concepts that are there, the three main approaches to the topic of religious diversity that philosophers of religion and theologians use, exclusivism, in which there's only one religious faith that's true, and saving. Pluralism, where multiple faiths are recognized as equally true and salvific, and inclusivism, where one religious tradition is true, but where salvation extends beyond the particular confines of that religion. The three moods in Kierkegaard that I'll be talking about are seriousness, irony, and humor. And what I'm going to do in part is to try to show that each of these positions on the topic of religious diversity correlates to one of these moods that Kierkegaard lays out. And then for those of you who are interested in philosophical theories of humor, there are three main approaches to understanding what's up with humor. One that plays on the theme of superiority. Thomas Hobbes is especially associated with this. We laugh when we feel superior to a person. So when we laugh at someone who takes a pratfall, that fits with that notion. A relief theory, this is typically associated with Freud, that when we've been tense and the tension is released, we laugh. And then finally, probably the predominant tradition is a contradiction notion, where when two ideas are incongruous in connection with each other, it generates humor. I've been asked to say a word at the end of the paper, perhaps, about the explosion of anger over the Danish cartoons. And I think it's a nice illustration of the incongruity, the contradiction theory of humor, to see the world angry at the Danes. Everyone, you know, there's nothing funny about people being angry at Americans. That's standard, expected, largely warranted. But the Danes, in my experience, have always been a sort of inoffensive, even cuddly people. And the idea of people up in arms and holding mass demonstrations in anger at the Danes, if it weren't tragic in the various ways that it is, it would have a humorous dimension. I think it'll come through that Kierkegaard's theory of humor is primarily the contradiction theory, but there are elements of both the relief and the superiority theory that come in as well. Okay. The popular conception of Kierkegaard, bequeathed us by uncounted surveys of existentialism, frames him in the binary logic of Pascal's wager. Believe or don't believe, leap or don't leap, Christian or atheist, either or, tertium non datur, a third is not given. Kierkegaard's actual writings defy this simplistic picture. His texts instead explore many different ways of being religious. His master's thesis describes Socrates' irony as a purely negative relation to the divine. His first major book, Either Or, portrays, among other things, the bourgeois religiosity of a lower court judge. Fear and Trembling, perhaps his most famous book on Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac, or preparing to make a sacrifice of Isaac, contrasts two types of religious existence: infinite resignation, in which one stands ready to give up everything out of love of God, and faith, in which one is able to receive back that which one has just given up. And later works by Kierkegaard contrast immanent religion, in which each of us finds God within, with transcendent religion, in which we encounter God as radically other and paradoxical. Since Kierkegaard's authorship is itself marked by religious diversity, and since he spent the last year of his life attacking the monolithic cultural Lutheranism of Denmark, it's worth asking whether he can help us think through our own issues of religious diversity. As our world has grown smaller and the reality of religious diversity has become more insistent, another binary opposition threatens to circumscribe our thought. Instead of Pascal's either-or, our responses to religious diversity seem to be framed by the options presented in William Butler Yeats' poem, The Second Coming. We seem pressed either toward a slack indifference in which religious belief is dismissed as a matter of personal preference, or toward an intolerant dismissal of any whose faith differs from our own. As Yeats put it, quote, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity," unquote. If philosophers of religion today are to have something to say to the world beyond the academy, it is surely this issue that they must engage. Can Kierkegaard, though himself a champion of either-ors, help us find a more attractive third way between indifference and intolerance? Can he help us combine integrity of religious commitment with a welcoming openness to people of other faiths? Addressing this issue to Kierkegaard's journals, the picture isn't initially promising. Kierkegaard's observations there about Judaism, the only non-Christian faith with which he had direct contact, are uniformly harsh and dismissive. Already in 1835, the first year of his journals, he refers to Judaism as a mere point of transition to Christianity. Subsequently, he sharpens the opposition, viewing Judaism as Christianity's foil, as the polar opposite of Christianity that, by, as he puts it, striking contrasts, makes it negatively manifest. Kierkegaard argues that Judaism was the necessary foreground to Christianity, not because of shared views of God or a shared salvation history, but because no other religion would serve so well as contrast. And I've read recently some of his statements about Islam. He didn't say much about Islam, but what he did say about it was fully as dismissive as what he says about Judaism. There is unfortunate evidence that Kierkegaard's exclusivist opinions weren't confined to his journals. A contemporary recounts an anti-Semitic exchange he had with Kierkegaard while working in a Jewish-owned bookshop in Copenhagen. Though in a famous passage in Kierkegaard's concluding unscientific postscript, he does recognize fervent pagan worship as more genuine than half-hearted Christian worship, we have to admit that we can't look to Kierkegaard either for a worked-out conception of religious diversity or for a personal example of how to coexist with people of other faiths. That said, I want to argue that Kierkegaard does provide us the conceptual tools to work out such a stance. My argument has four parts. First, I will survey prevailing philosophical and theological paradigms for thinking about religious diversity. Second, I will discuss the concept of mood as originally developed by Kierkegaard and then given theoretical development by Heidegger. Third, I will argue that Kierkegaard's phenomenology of moods, his description of the various moods, offers us a fruitful way to reconceive and move beyond the dominant tripartite scheme for thinking about religious diversity. And finally, I will focus on one particular mood, humor, as especially helpful in this project. The classic text for presenting Kierkegaard's theory of humor is the concluding unscientific postscript, and I will survey his comments there. Unfortunately, those comments are as scattered and ambiguous as they are provocative and promising. But by returning to Kierkegaard's first journal entries on humor from 1836 to 1837, a decade before he wrote the postscript, we're able to discern a developmental direction that should inform our reading of the later text. In those journal entries, Kierkegaard works toward a theory of Christian humor in which faith itself checks our tendencies to hubris, in which depth of religious commitment prevents rather than promotes religious intolerance and oppression. Kierkegaard thus offers a basis for coexisting with people of other faiths, not just while, but precisely by maintaining genuine commitment to one's own faith. Section 1 is on prevailing paradigms for thinking about religious diversity. Recent philosophical and theological discussions of religious diversity are overwhelmingly structured around the tripartite scheme of exclusivism, pluralism, and inclusivism, which I have at the top of your handout briefly described. Exclusivism asserts the unique truth and salvific power of a single faith. Pluralism asserts that multiple faiths are equally true and redemptive. Inclusivism asserts that a particular faith is uniquely true, but acknowledges the relative truth of other faiths and extends redemption beyond the confines of its own religious community. While detailed discussion of these paradigms is beyond the scope of this paper, I will identify what I take to be the key ideas and guiding experiences of each. Exclusivism at root draws the consequences of Aristotle's principle of non-contradiction. To assert the truth of P is unavoidably to deny the truth of not P. Granted, religious belief isn't reducible to its propositional content, but without some such content, belief is utterly vacuous. So to believe anything definite is unavoidably to deny all other beliefs contradictory to that belief. Since the various religious faiths often involve mutually exclusive claims, commitment to the truths of one inevitably involves denial of at least some aspects of others. To blunt the politically incorrect impression of this view, exclusivists often draw parallels to moral convictions. Alvin Plantinga, a well-known American philosopher of religion, for example, notes that the existence of racial bigots does not and should not undermine our commitment to racial equality. All we can do in the face of moral disagreement is to commit ourselves to what seems right, full in the knowledge that we simultaneously commit ourselves to the view that those who disagree with us are wrong. While exclusivists appeal to our experience of moral disagreement and disapproval, pluralists appeal to our experiences of moral approval of those of different faiths. John Hick, the best known of the pluralists, traces his own conversion to pluralism to his personal experiences of the sanctity of people of other faiths. The evident transformative power of the world's great religious traditions convinces Hick that each is equally in touch with the divine. His problem is how to get around exclusivism's compelling point that contradictory beliefs can't simultaneously be true. Using Kant's distinction between the noumenal, how reality is in itself, and the phenomenal, how reality appears to us, Hick argues that each religious tradition is a way of experiencing a divine reality that ultimately eludes all of our conceptual nets. Hick employs at least three metaphors to convey his pluralist view. Jastrow's duck rabbit. Are you familiar with the duck rabbit? I meant to print off a photo of it. It's used in Wittgenstein. Yeah, where it's a figure that can be equally well taken as a duck or a rabbit. And so Hick refers to that. He also refers to physics' description of light as both a particle and a wave, and to cartographers' use of two-dimensional maps to represent three-dimensional reality. The point of each of these metaphors is to problematize the relation between the divine and all references to it, thus rendering apparent disagreements simply matters of imperfect descriptions of diverse phenomenal aspects. What we've seen in the cases of exclusivism and pluralism is a rather rigid linkage of agreement with approval and disagreement with disapproval. The exclusivist disapproves, for example, by labeling another faith as heathen, infidel, or pagan, because she disagrees. The pluralist, in contrast, agrees by recognizing as equally true the other faith, because she approves by recognizing sanctity. The inclusivist, the third of the options, at first seems to articulate a more complex relationship between approval and agreement by appealing to the obscurity of human self-knowledge. Just as Molière's Monsieur Jourdain discovers that he's been speaking prose all of his life without knowing it, so Rahner's anonymous Christians incompletely grasp their own religious identities. However they describe themselves as Buddhist or Muslim or Jewish or whatever, they're already included in the church invisible insofar as they're genuinely people of faith. The logic here seems to be that since I approve by finding your life sanctified, holy in some way, I can't believe that our disagreement with each other is as real, deep, and ultimate as it appears to be. Thus, the inference from approval to agreement, the characteristic thought of pluralism, remains in place. Nonetheless, there is something distinctive about inclusivism. It seems to me to be struggling toward a more complex, internally conflicted view of religious plurality in contrast to the one-dimensional acceptance that's characteristic of pluralism or the total rejection we see in the case of exclusivism. In both committing itself to the unique validity of the Christian faith and embracing those of other faiths, inclusivism seems to be trying to think two thoughts at once. And I'm drawn to that aspect of inclusivism. I want to come back to that. While significant work has been done within the tripartite conceptual scheme that I've just described, it has its distinct limits. For none of the options appears very attractive. Exclusivism blithely consigns the majority of the human race to the outer darkness. Pluralism empties the idea of the divine of all content so as to embrace equally all manner of religious of different beliefs. And inclusivism runs a real risk of condescending to other faiths. Like inclusivism, it claims unique truth for its own faith, but it accommodates those who get it wrong. While extending salvation more broadly seems compassionate, it comes at the price of not taking seriously the religious commitments of others. Rahner's notion of anonymous Christians comes dangerously close to the Mormon practice of baptizing deceased non-Mormons as Mormons. Both seem to fall short of minimal standards of informed consent. I'm not sure Mormonism is a familiar religious topic here in Malta, but as I understand it, the Mormon work in genealogy is not idle curiosity. It's so as to identify people in the past and baptize them as Mormons. I'm worried that Rahner's notion of anonymous Christians comes close to that. While I find the prevailing paradigms unsatisfactory, they dominate discussions of the topic far too thoroughly to make simply dismissing them a live option. I propose instead to reconceive the three paradigms by viewing them through the lens of Kierkegaard's concept of mood. This reframing of the paradigms will reinforce my dissatisfaction with exclusivism and pluralism, but will, I hope, identify more adequately what is right about inclusivism. As I said, specifically, its tentative movement toward a more complex and even conflicted attitude. And that leads me to section two of the paper on the topic of mood, which I entitle Moods as Fundamental Forms of World Disclosure. I'm sure some of you will recognize the Heideggerian language I'm slipping into there. Throughout the history of philosophy, emotions have been assigned a decidedly inferior role, far behind both cognitions and volitions and attention and prestige. Philosophers have tended to view emotions as too subjective, ephemeral, irrational, and ineffable, either to warrant or to bear systematic scrutiny. That bias has come under challenge recently, notably in Martha Nussbaum's book, Upheavals of Thought, which forcefully argues for the integral role of the emotions in both cognition and action. But even Nussbaum, emotions self-appointed defender, finds it hard to say anything positive, for that matter, to say much of anything at all about moods. In a typically massive volume, The Upheavals of Thought, she manages only a short section on moods, and there she refers to them as mere moods. Why the disrespect? Central to Nussbaum's brief on behalf of emotions is their intentionality, their aboutness, their directedness at something particular. So belief is intentional. I believed that I had the funds in the bank to cover my check. Emotions are also intentional. I'm angry that it didn't when my check bounces. But moods don't have that intentional structure in the way that beliefs and emotions do. Nussbaum writes, "Emotions always have an object, even if it is a vague object. They always invest the object with value and involve the acceptance of beliefs about the object. Moods, such as irritation, gloom, elation, and equanimity, lack these characteristics." Unquote. I believe that was, I don't think I put that on my list of quotations. What an oversight. Nussbaum's primarily or even purely negative characterization of mood as an affective state lacking intentionality leads her to view it as nothing more than a subjective coloring of our psychological life. And in that, she ironically repeats the dismissive gesture that she's at such pains to correct in the case of the emotions. But another philosophical tradition, begun by Kierkegaard and brought to full theoretical development by Heidegger, locates the fundamental significance of mood precisely in its non-intentionality. Mood is not about any particular aspect of the world. Rather, mood is the way the world as a whole reveals itself. If I can speak Heideggerese for a moment, and here I do have the quotation. Quentin Smith, paraphrasing, trying to capture what Heidegger is saying, writes, "Moods are not sensuous states that belong to the lower irrational and appetitive faculty of the soul, and which often lead rational man astray from his calm intellectual contemplation and deliberate conduct. That's the classic philosophical view of mood. Rather, moods are a fundamental way in which Dasein, Heidegger's word for the human person, is aware of its being in the world, and which are more ontologically primordial than the rational thematization of being as something that lies at hand before the contemplative intellect. It is not reason that gives Dasein its basic access to being, but moods." I think Alfonso Lingus makes the point more clearly, more poetically, when he writes, "The world extends resplendent or desolate and oppressive, laughing and full of promise, or menacing and evil. Mood is how we are tuned into the layout, or how the layout reverberates and resonates in us. The world which extends far about us and whose forms our practical look surveys is felt to affect us. Its materiality matters to us. the world is grasped formally in the practical looking about and looking for and is sensed materially in mood. That's better. But Wittgenstein gets it even better than that, more succinctly and more vividly, when he writes in the Tractatus that the world of the happy man is a different one from that of the unhappy one. Press Wittgenstein to boil it down to something terser. But that idea of the unhappy man and the happy man living in two fundamentally different worlds really gets at this idea that world is the way, that mood is the way in which the world appears to us in a total fashion. What Heidegger explicates in turgid German, replete with hyphens and neologisms, Kierkegaard realizes in literary form. While Kierkegaard does approach mood theoretically in several books, The Concept of Anxiety, The Sickness Unto Death, that isn't his primary way of engaging mood. Rather, he creates a variety of oddly named characters, pseudonyms. Some example, Victor Eremita, the victorious hermit, Vigilius Halfniensis, the watchman of the harbor, Johannes de Silentio, John of Silence, and even Hilarious Bookbinder is one that shows up later. All these different characters. And each of these pseudonyms, these different characters, ideally represents a life view, a particular stage on life's way, as Kierkegaard puts it. And they each write books from their own perspectives. You'll frequently see people making the mistake of saying, Kierkegaard said so-and-so, when actually it's one of Kierkegaard's pseudonyms who said it. Kierkegaard's creative act was to create the character, the pseudonym, who then has his, in all cases, unfortunately, his own view of the world, and lays it out. But Kierkegaard goes to great lengths to say, no, don't confuse these people's descriptions, discussions of the world with my own views. They're separate. Kierkegaard exercises a fascination over many, myself included, in no small part because of his ability to change style radically as he goes from book to book, from pseudonym to pseudonym. Here, style is philosophically significant. Each of his pseudonym style captures not just a distinctive set of beliefs or values, it captures the way the world appears to that person. That is to say, the style of each book captures the mood of its archetypal character. Thus, in his pseudonymous authorship, Kierkegaard offers what Vincent McCarthy aptly calls a phenomenology of moods, that is, a philosophical engagement with a variety of fundamental moods that attends as closely to how the world looks and feels to the pseudonymous characters as it does to what the characters believe and do. And that brings me to section 3 of the paper, where I try to take these two concepts, mood on the one hand and the issue of religious pluralism, of religious diversity, and connect them to each other. And I'll begin with a quotation from Alvin Plantinga, once again, a leading figure in American philosophy of religion. In an essay forthrightly defending religious exclusivism, Alvin Plantinga writes this, "And my problem is this, when I become really aware of these other ways of looking at the world, these other ways of responding religiously to the world, what must or should I do? What is the right attitude to take?" Unquote. I think Plantinga asks exactly the right passage, the right question in this passage. But it isn't the question that most philosophers of religion have asked when confronted with the reality of plural faiths. Philosophers trained to focus on the truth or falsity of beliefs have focused almost exclusively on the question of how to think about the incompatible truth claims of the various faiths. But Plantinga's question about what attitude to take toward other ways of responding religiously to the world turns the question back from the object, the person of another faith and her beliefs, to the subject of that awareness, to myself as I'm asking the question. And with that shift, the question changes profoundly. When I move from asking, how can multiple religions which make incompatible truth claims simultaneously be true, to the question, what attitude is best for me to take toward the multiple faiths which I encounter, then I become the object of my own scrutiny. John Hick has written of his encounter with multiple faiths, occasioning in him a sort of Copernican revolution. What Hick has in mind is a transition from a Christocentric theology, which he regards as inherently exclusivistic, to a God-centered theology, which he thinks is much more accommodating of religious diversity. But the Copernican revolution that is most relevant to the field of philosophy is Immanuel Kant's critical philosophy, in which the knowing subject, not the known object, becomes the focus of attention. It is in that Kantian spirit that I seize on Plantinga's question about attitude and call for a fundamental recasting of the question of religious diversity as a question about our own attitudinal stance toward other religions, and not initially as a question about their truth or falsity. So I want to make my attitude toward other religions the primary question, not the truth or falsity of those other religious views. Martha Nussbaum, again, in another writing, makes a brief suggestive comment along these lines in an essay on the topic of religious intolerance. And this is on the handout. She writes, "Two ideas typically foster religious intolerance and disrespect. The first is that one's own religion is the only true religion, and that other religions are false or morally incorrect. But people possessed of this view can also believe that others deserve respect for their committed beliefs, so long as they do no harm. Much more dangerous is the second idea, that the state and private citizens should coerce people into adhering to the correct religious approach. Pluralists have focused entirely on the first exclusivist belief as the source of religious intolerance and oppression. They have laid the blame on exclusivism for bloody centuries of religious violence, and have argued that until truth claims are effectively abandoned, we can't hope to get along with each other. But Nussbaum says that exclusivism, per se, isn't necessarily violent or oppressive. And I think history is rather obviously on her side in this. My students and I have recently returned from Turkey. As I understand it, through long periods of the Ottoman Empire, the Ottomans were quite sure that Islam was the true faith, but they tolerated Jews and Christians within their empire in a relatively civil fashion. What worries Nussbaum is the attitude one assumes toward those one takes to be wrong. It is when adherents of one faith come to view the adherents of another faith as an offense, as unendurable, as an abomination, as needing to be coerced, that religious violence is close at hand. In other words, the crucial issue is the attitude of the subject viewing the adherent of the other faith rather than the truth or falsity of the other's beliefs. I submit that Kierkegaard is a significant resource for facilitating this Copernican revolution in the philosophy of religion. By making mood a central category in his work, Kierkegaard makes us self-conscious about the determining role that mood plays in the way that the world appears to us. Since that world includes the religious other, the mood that structures our being in the world determines the way the religious other appears to us, either as a threat, or an irrelevancy, as a fellow seeker, as a child of God to be loved, a real variety of ways in which the religious other can manifest herself or himself. This subjective turn, this focusing of the thinker upon herself, and specifically upon her mood, is clearly in keeping with the overall thrust of Kierkegaard's philosophy, which emphasizes subjectivity, emphasizes reference to self. Kierkegaard's usefulness to the question of religious pluralism, however, is more specific than such a general encouragement to self-consciously attend to mood. He offers specific analyses and literary realizations of three moods, seriousness, irony, and humor, that I have listed on the handout. And these, I will argue, correlate to the three perspectives on religious diversity that we've talked about, exclusivism, pluralism, and inclusivism. In his writings, Kierkegaard investigates irony in his master's thesis, looking at Socrates as a dominant manifestation of it. And then in his first major published work, Either Or, he brings irony to life in the person of a young aesthete who resolves to take nothing in life very seriously. He turns to the mood of seriousness in the second volume of Either Or, where we have these very, very long letters by a lower court judge on the topic of marriage. And I think it's safe to say that Judge William undertakes those letters in a spirit of grave solemnness. And then Kierkegaard's key, his core philosophical writings, the philosophical fragments and the concluding unscientific proscript, are written by one Johannes Climacus, John the Climber, who describes himself as a humorist, and that's where we primarily encounter the mood of humor. Exclusivism, I would like to argue, correlates to the mood of seriousness. To be serious is to coincide with oneself, to inhabit one's beliefs seamlessly, so that one can only respond to conflicting beliefs by rejecting them. And I go on to argue here that there are, I think, several forms of seriousness. One is a sort of non-reflective seriousness that I would tie to Gadamer's analysis of the child at play. But what's more interesting for our purposes is a reflective seriousness. When a person is aware of an alternative to his or her views of the world, but clings doggedly to them nonetheless. And clearly that is what we see in the case of religious exclusivism. I turn again to Alvin Plantinga as a good illustration of that. There's a passage I have where he turns again to the issue of moral judgments. And I think we'll see in this passage how solidly he inhabits his own religious views and deals with disagreement by just saying, I've got to disagree with you, you're wrong, I'm right. Plantinga writes, I'm dead sure that it is wrong to try to advance my career by telling lies about my colleagues, and I realize that there are those who disagree. I also realize that in all likelihood, there is no way I can find to show them that they are wrong. Nonetheless, I think that they are wrong. If I think this after careful reflection, if I consider the claims of those who disagree as sympathetically as I can, if I try level best to ascertain the truth here, and it still seems to me sleazy, wrong, and despicable to lie about my colleagues to advance my career, could I really be doing something immoral in continuing to believe as before? I can't see how. So that's the parallel that Plantinga wants to draw in the case of religious disagreements. Plantinga sticks to his guns, to use the colloquial. He chooses to continue to inhabit his beliefs unreservedly, to feel at home in them, even after encountering alternative beliefs. This, I submit, isn't just an act of cognitive assent, of saying yes. It reveals a mood, a way of encountering the world as full of divergent beliefs that I mustn't let throw me off course. It is the experiential mode that correlates to a certain epistemic doggedness. Here I stand, I can do no other, to quote Luther. But now on to irony. Pluralism, I suggest, corresponds to the mood of irony. That suggestion may seem odd, since pluralists, such as John Hick, seem awfully serious about their embrace of religious diversity. But recall Richard Rorty's well-known characterization of irony, and this is again in the quotations. Rorty writes, I shall define an ironist as someone who fulfills three conditions. First, she has radical and continuing doubts about the final vocabulary she currently uses because she has been impressed by other vocabularies taken as final by people or books she has encountered. Second, she realizes that argument phrased in her present vocabulary can neither underwrite nor dissolve these doubts. Third, insofar as she philosophizes about her situation, she does not think that her vocabulary is closer to reality than others, that it is in touch with a power, not herself. The first two parts of that definition admirably capture Hick's pluralism, and the third point only needs minor modification. The religious pluralist regards all major religious traditions as equally in touch with a power not herself. The key point here is that to see one's own faith as one of numerously equally valid religious options is to distance oneself reflectively from it. to use an image from Aristophanes' Clouds, of which Kierkegaard was quite fond, it is to hover, as Socrates does, above the thoughtery. One doesn't so much believe in one particular religion as one believes. As Joseph Runzo, is that part of the Maltese idiom that you put the scare quotes around something as a way of putting it into question? So I'm suggesting that the ironist only believes. As Joseph Runzo puts it, uncritical pluralism undermines the strength of commitment to faith, unquote. So irony and pluralism are both characterized by a certain sort of distance and tentativeness in relation to their viewpoints. One hesitates here to speak of beliefs. They wear ideological loose clothing, which, as in the case of the beloved disciple in the Garden of Gethsemane, slips away when someone tries to seize them by it. And that brings me to humor, the mood that I propose as correlative to inclusivism. Though I made critical comments about inclusivism above, I do appreciate its openness to complexity and tension, its willingness to think two opposing thoughts at the same time. Inclusivism takes up the right challenge to remain fully committed, yet to take full account of other faiths. But how to pull that off? To insist, as inclusivists do, that one's own faith is the true one, while allowing others some sort of honorary membership, isn't really to move away from seriousness, I submit. Another more internally complex mood is needed, one that can accommodate the distinctive stances of commitment and openness at the same time, one that will allow for a more nuanced relationship between agreement and approval than we have seen in either exclusivism or pluralism. Humor, I submit, is a plausible candidate for that role. Conrad Hayers describes religious humor, or as he puts it, holy laughter, as a complex dialectic of seriousness and playfulness. He writes, quote, "The comic is fundamentally a certain attitude toward and perspective on life. The essential element in relation to the sacred is the periodic suspension of seriousness and sacrality, the comic spirit, and the realization of the playful, game-like comic perspective," end quote. But this suspension of seriousness is, paradoxically, grounded in seriousness. Hayers later writes, quote, "Seriousness is the prerequisite and the ground of humor. It is the precondition apart from which humor would be reduced to cynical contempt. Humor, as the profanation of the sacred, is to be differentiated from that which has no basis in the sacred, from that which is not grounded in faith," close quote. This paradoxical vision of a seriousness that checks and even suspends itself and a playfulness that is deeply rooted in serious commitment is promising, but it's in need of conceptual articulation. I propose that Kierkegaard's analysis of humor goes a long ways toward such an articulation. And that brings me into the final section, Kierkegaard's analysis of humor. Kierkegaard's most significant published statements on humor are found in his quite large 1846 work, The Concluding Unscientific Postscript, which is attributed to the pseudonym Johannes Climacus. This text lives up to its self-description in its treatment of humor. It is highly unscientific, in that statements about humor are widely scattered through the text, often in footnotes, and they are sufficiently fragmentary, oblique, and even contradictory to require considerable work of the interpreter. Thankfully, several scholars, notably Robert Roberts, Steve Evans, and John Lippitt, have set themselves to the task of piecing together Kierkegaard's tantalizing remarks on humor. I'll highlight just a few main works from their points from their work. First, Climacus is not an ordinary language philosopher, observing the way that people typically use the term humor. He refers to Christianity as the most humorous worldview and says that the humorist, like the religious individual, has an essential conception of suffering, seeing the way in which suffering is built into the very structure of human existence and isn't some sort of random, accidental thing. I don't think a lot of us would refer to that as a humorous worldview. So he's a long ways from standard uses of the term. Second, Climacus aligns himself with the tradition that relates humor and contradiction. I laid out the three main views of humor over there, and I'm going to highlight the contradiction view. That is, some sort of incongruity, some contrastive juxtaposition is essential to humor. This helps us to understand Kierkegaard's surprising linkage of humor and religion. He writes, quote, The humorist continually joins the conception of God together with something else and brings out the contradiction, close quote. The idea here is that the greatness of God set over against the smallness of all that we do and know and are renders us more than a bit funny from the divine perspective. The humorist has just enough of a sense of that perspective that humor becomes her life view, her fundamental mood, and not just an episodic diversion. Third point, humor involves not just contradiction, as Climacus puts it, but a way out, a resolution or an escape from the contradiction. Inescapable, irresolvable contradiction is tragic. An unrelieved sense of our smallness and insignificance leads to nihilism. True humor differs from both in finding a way to rise above the contradiction to a higher reconciling perspective. And here you get the relief and the superiority views of humor coming in a bit. True humor differs, again, we see why Climacus tends to associate humor and Christianity, which offers not just a higher perspective, but also promises grace and redemption as ways out of tragic contradictions in which we mire ourselves. Fourth point, humor as mood orients the subject toward the world in a manner that combines humility with lack of urgency. As John Lippitt puts it, the humorist is laid back in a certain way. A sense of the disproportion between God and ourselves inoculates, or at least it should, against hubris and inflated self-image. And that in turn saves us from an undue sense of how much ultimately is up to us, allowing us to take a bit more in life with the proverbial grain of salt. The relevance of this view of humor to the issue of religious pluralism is evident, I hope. One would hardly expect to find the humorist striking the match for the auto da fe. What isn't at all evident is how Climacus ultimately wants us to think about humor. He variously describes it as an alternative perspective to Christianity, as the incognita, that is the hidden face of the face of Christianity that hides its inner reality. And he also talks about it as a component aspect of Christianity. Different scholars of Kierkegaard on this topic emphasize different views, and they all find passages that back up what they're saying. Given that sort of ambiguity, I want to turn just briefly to one passage from the journals in 1837. And this is the last of the quotations that I have on there. This is a cryptic passage, but I think it's a rich one. In this passage in 1837, Kierkegaard wrote, "The humorous, present throughout Christianity, is expressed in a fundamental principle which declares that the truth is hidden in the mystery, which teaches not only that the truth is found in a mystery, an assertion which the world generally has been more inclined to hear, since mysteries have arisen often enough, although the ones initiated into these mysteries promptly apprehended the rest of the world in a humorous vein, but that it is in fact hidden in the mystery. This is a view of life which regards worldly wisdom humorously to the nth degree. Otherwise, the truth is usually revealed in mystery." Now that, I submit, is a fairly cryptic passage that requires a certain amount of puzzling out. Here, Kierkegaard links Christianity and humor through a close reading of Colossians chapter 1, 26. Those remarks were fairly directly tied to the text of Colossians 1, 26. He specifically contrasts the Christian teaching that truth is hidden in mystery with the alternative notion of truth revealed in mystery. So the contrast is truth hidden in mystery versus truth revealed in mystery. What precisely is the significance of this contrast. When truth is viewed as revealed, those granted the revelation know better and are able to laugh at those who are not in the know. As Kierkegaard puts it, they promptly apprehend the rest of the world in a humorous vein. This fits well with one dominant theory of humor, the superiority view. But when, as in Christianity, truth is hidden in mystery, all such pretension is blocked. In the next paragraph that's not quoted yet, Kierkegaard goes on to write, quote, "No matter how much Christian knowledge increases, it will still always remember its origin and therefore know everything in mystery," end quote. Several points are in order here. First, Kierkegaard offers a complex concept of revelation which asserts both genuine knowledge of the divine, recall that he speaks of an increase of Christian knowledge, and of God's ultimate hiddenness. In a note that he later appended to this entry, he wrote, "The concept of revelation can in itself very well include the concept of the hidden," close quote. The mindset required by such a concept of revelation is exactly the divided, self-conflicted attitude that I think is needed to deal with the topic, with the phenomenon of religious pluralism. The believer both needs a real sense of contact with the divine and an equally strong sense of the partial, provisional, and flawed character of that conduct, contact. Second, Kierkegaard here notes the polemical dimension of the divine, the way the absolute relativizes all before it, that it applies to believers as well as to non-believers. That is, the superiority dimension of humor, the sense of knowing better than the butt of the joke, isn't claimed for oneself, but is reserved for God. Kierkegaard turns to this reflexive dimension of humor in an undated passage from 1837, where he writes, quote, "The ironical position is nil admirari, admire nothing. But irony, when it slays itself, has disdained everything with humor, itself included." So it's irony when you call into question everything in the world outside of yourself. It's only humor when that turns back on oneself and calls into question oneself. Third, the check on the hubris that characterizes exclusivism doesn't come from some source external to one's faith. Rather, it comes from that faith itself. Note that Kierkegaard moved to his self-reflexive view of humor through a careful reading of the New Testament, Colossians 1:26. And similarly, in an entry from August of 1837, he links humor and Christian weakness by reflecting on Calvin's commentary on 2 Corinthians 13:4. In contrasts, pluralists typically challenge exclusivist tendencies by citing universally available considerations. Hick, as we saw, claims that the study of world religions shows comparable levels of sanctity in the followers of those faiths. But to check one's tendency to arrogant self-satisfaction by considerations external to that faith calls into question the integrity of one's faith commitment. One relies on a criterion alien to one's faith to critique and shape that faith. But that makes faith provisional and secondary. No such problem of diminished or mixed loyalty arises when one finds grounds for a humble, self-critical faith within that faith itself. And then to close, the vision of humor that Kierkegaard offers here represents a promising model of deep commitment to one's own faith that not only leaves room for, but which specifically prompts a respectful openness to others of other faiths. To know that I know only in part, through a glass darkly, and to know how far I am from living out the little that I do know, to know, in short, how comical I am myself in God's eyes, should leave me with sympathy for those who share my plight, whatever their faith, and an eagerness to learn whatever I can from their partial glimpses of divine truth. This stance toward people of other faiths eludes both exclusivists and pluralists. Exclusivists are too sure that they have a secure grasp on the truth to be humbly open. Pluralists cut themselves off from the very basis of humble openness by ironically distancing themselves from their convictions. Humor, as a combination of commitment and humble openness, isn't identical to exclusivism, but I think it captures what inclusivists are aiming for: fidelity to one's own faith, together with respectful, humble openness to those of other faiths. Thanks.
George, I want to thank you very much for an extremely rich and at the same time clear reflection on the topic of religious diversity and humor. I have a number of questions I would like to ask, but, and I'm sure other people do too, but rather than preoccupy the discussion with questions which come to mind, I think I'm going to open the floor immediately for discussion, and I'll just see the way the wind blows and come in with what question seems appropriate. An extremely small side comment. One of the attractive qualities in your paper is that it reminds me personally of G.K. Chesterton's emphasis on humor, on a sense of the ridiculous, on almost a sense of the quasi-mad quality of belief as being essential and implicit in the religious disposition. But that's just a personal comment. So over to the audience, and if you could please fumble with the microphone as best you can. Any questions?
The seriousness is connected to the ethical sphere, and here, irony to the aesthetic, and so humorous to the religious dimension. How would that connect with that? You know, the story of Abraham. Does it connect in the way that, you know, since God is so different from other, and from, you know, God's point of view, we're all laughable, then that episode is something to, it can't be something to laugh at. I can't.
That's a good point. It's hard to find much that's very funny in most of Fear and Trembling. It's not so much in the text of Fear and Trembling as in the writings on religion by Johannes Climacus that one sees that association. Kierkegaard said a number of times that the Christian faith in particular, religion in general, is dialectical. And what he meant by that is that you can never describe it in univocal terms. You need to use contradictory language frequently to describe it. What's really coming through in the Fear and Trembling text is the horror religiosus, the terrifying, the horrible, the horrifying, the daunting dimensions of religion. And he would be the last person to ignore those, to eliminate those. But there is this also this dimension of the humorous. I think the way I would connect it is this, that after standing on Mount Moriah before the face of God, being called upon to offer your son in sacrifice, that sort of overwhelming experience of contact with the sublime, one will return to the plane and will not get too upset about the parking ticket, about the there are all sorts of things in life that we might tend to get upset about that would then be put in a sort of perspective by that encounter with the divine. So I actually think that the horrifying and the humorous are intimately related at some level.
Incidentally, but someone who's not here, Father Peters, thinks of Jesus as a kind of clown because of his, you know, it's comical but sad, and similar to what you're saying, that, you know, the clown is one who falls, but and then he brushes himself and keeps on going. Mm-hmm. That's kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
No, I'm just interested in the literary. The tragic versus the comic, where you everything ends happy, the ultimate reward in heaven, and is that a happy end?
Kierkegaard thought that the comic and the tragic were closely related to each other, that both were based on contradiction of some sort. The difference is whether there is some sort of resolution ultimately that relieves the tragic. So he sees them as rather closely related, and in fact, he has a good basis in classical philosophy for that. If you know Plato's Symposium, just before everyone passes out drunk at the end of a night of discussing love, someone hears Socrates arguing that the best tragic playwright is also the best comic playwright, that the same skills lead to both. And Aristotle was really the first theorist of both comedy and tragedy. So there's interesting material in Kierkegaard on the close connectedness of the tragic and the comic.
I was quite intrigued with the use of Karl Rahner as an example of the danger of sliding into exclusivism, or rather as someone who presents himself as an inclusivist, following your categorization. Because to me, Rahner always seemed as someone who tried pushing for the fidelity to one's faith while being, as you said, humbly open towards other faiths, mm-hmm. in a particular historical circumstance. That is, his main aim was, of course, to try and change the predominant view in the Catholic Church at the time of Vatican II. So when you said that, speaking of even of anonymous Christians, it can tend into slide into being quite looking down on other religions, I'd like to know a bit mm-hmm. of what your views about Rahner on this point it would be.
Yeah, I think I'm really sympathetic with Rahner as trying to think two things at once. Fidelity, he has very strong statements on how deeply committed he is to the ultimate truth of the Christian faith. But as you say, there's also this openness that he's trying to achieve. I'm sympathetic to that. I think what I'm raising questions about is the way that he finds to put those two things together, his notion of anonymous Christians, where you essentially are saying that even if people don't know it, even if people don't know it, they're part of the church invisible. Even if they're not part of the institutional church, really deep down, they're Christians. I think it would be easy for someone who's not Christian to take offense at being told that whether you know it or not, you're really a Christian. In that way. Yeah, that I think that as good as Rahner's impulse is, that the way that he finds to formulate that ultimately falls back into the basic logic of exclusivism.
Is there maybe I missed it, but I didn't hear a whole lot about personal religious practice, and is there any notion that as you get older, you know, you think more about mortality and the hereafter, mm-hmm. and was there a change in his mood, if I could phrase it that way?
Well, he's an interesting combination of the way that humor is a internally conflicted, complex mood that has an essential serious component. I think that the contact with God on Mount Moriah that's described in the book Fear and Trembling is that moment of seriousness, that sense of standing before God and being called by God to act in a certain way and taking that deeply seriously. That is always there in Kierkegaard. He regarded himself as a religious exception, as someone who had been appointed a particular task by God, and he was deeply committed to carrying it out. But he did it by the use of humor, that in many instances his primary weapon in carrying out his serious task of challenging the Danish Lutheran Church was to make fun of it. And he had quite a wicked pen. He found all sorts of ways to make laughable the clerical establishment, the philosophical establishment, in Denmark. So I would say that Kierkegaard's authorship, Kierkegaard's person, is an excellent example of humor in the service of a serious end.
But I guess my question really was more, would you see in his life a transition, a change in his perspective of the church? I mean, mm-hmm. he grew up obviously where, you know, he went to church, but did he change his practices? Did he change his... Is there any evidence
that? Oh, the topic of Kierkegaard's biography is I think probably more effort has been spent on understanding that than Kirchhoffer would think was a good idea. Yeah, he's a very complex person. He was deeply depressed in the 1830s to the point that he was almost suicidal. But in 1838, he has some sort of religious experience that gives him an indescribable joy. So, you know, he did experience Christianity as both relieving him from a crushing melancholy and depression, but then he's quite aware of the ways in which his notions of a rather terrible God in many ways gave him a certain darkness of mood. And I might throw this out on the topic of Kirchhoffer's biography. Paul had said it might be interesting to talk about the whole flap about the Danish cartoons and Islam in reference to this notion of humor and religious coexistence. It doesn't seem that my notion that humor is going to be helpful for having people of different faiths live together in tranquility is coming true. You know, it seems that humor is a source of contention there. And so I was wondering, what would Kirchhoffer say about this phenomenon? It's perhaps important to keep in mind that he himself became the object of Danish cartoonists. There was a scurrilous magazine that was published in the 1840s in Denmark called The Corsair. And this magazine would actually pay maids and serving men in houses to come and dish dirt on the people that they work for. It was engaged in recreational character assassination in a big way, and Kirchhoffer took them on by making fun of them. And they unleashed a cartoon barrage against Kirchhoffer so that he couldn't go out in public on the streets of Copenhagen without being derided, without people making fun of him. So he knew how tough the Danish cartoonists could be. I think it's complex to know exactly what he would make of this flap, and I think that's illustrated by the fact that the former and the current directors of the Kirchhoffer Library, when asked about this, gave radically conflicting answers. The 94-year-old Howard Hong stood with the Danish comics and said if Kirchhoffer had drawn those cartoons, he wouldn't apologize, he wouldn't withdraw them. He was a comic who dished out and gave it to people hard. His successor, the current head of the Kirchhoffer Library, would say that Kirchhoffer had deep sympathy for the Islamic believers for the seriousness of their belief. So I think it would be a difficult thing to pin down exactly where Kirchhoffer would stand on that.
I think what we are talking about here is the question you pose and then seek to answer in your final argument, which is that how does one articulate playfulness with seriousness? And you proceed to a very clear argument, which I take it comes as much from you as it does from Kierkegaard. And this is the idea that in the light of any concept of God, we are more than a bit funny. Mm-hmm. And in terms of that, then we must treat even our most urgent and deeply committed acts as being in somehow unfathomably, in some sense unfathomably small, however unfathomably necessary we may take them to be. I mean, I take your argument, but I think we need to explore this articulation a bit more. And so anyway.
Personally, I'm still kind of edgy about my understanding of this concept of humor and not humor. I mean, putting it in a certain way, the only thing which I could think of humor is, for example, I don't know, it's something like the beheading of St. John, like knowing that he was beheaded for a dance, for a simple dance. It's kind of humorous in a sense, although it's not that humorous. And secondly, so this concept of humor, does it go up a level which goes beyond religion per se? I would be referring to Bergson, for example, and his idea of two moralities. We have, you know, like the religious morality and the more spiritual morality, where he refers to Gnosis and stuff like that. So would humor be more on that second higher form of morality or religion or faith?
I haven't read deeply in Bergson on humor, and that would be a good thing to turn to. But that notion of transcending, moving to a higher level, a higher perspective, is certainly one of the motifs that that is coming through here, I think. Your reference to St. John's beheading, there certainly is contrast there. I wonder if there is the sort of relief from that that makes it humorous. I'm not sure that all manifestations of contrast and contradiction are immediately humorous in that regard. Could you say more about the two levels that you were talking about?
It's not talking about humor, but you know, like one level is where you live a moral life, you have a value system which is tied to the religion, mm-hmm. as an institution, as a social, okay. The one we have learned through family and stuff. And then there is the second level, which is more based on the spiritual life, mm-hmm. where you have this direct encounter with God. And, you know, like the people that would come to mind would be, you know, like Teresa of Avila, mm-hmm.
right.
Sufi.
Absolutely, I think Kierkegaard is moving in that second direction. His character, Judge William, the ethicist in second volume of Either Or, is someone who takes over the inherited mores and belief structures of society and just inhabits them without much critical distance. He defends them. He is completely serious about them. They seem to be completely adequate to them. I think that what Kierkegaard is talking about by humor is a stance toward mores and beliefs that has built into it an element of irony, an element of distance, an element of questioning that frees one up from that which would become too staid, too rigid, too fixed, too conventional. It is ultimately, humor is this complex dialectic of irony and seriousness brought together in coexistence. And it sounds as if that's what Bergson is talking about as well in the mystics.
I think this is a possibly fruitful line to explore for a minute, because one's looking here at the whole relationship between humor and the social institutions of religious mm-hmm. belief, and that immediately leads to the consideration of actual characters one might use as philosophical examples. And the example, of course, which comes to mind deals with the two levels Francois just talked about. One feels, and I'm sure you can elucidate as far as Kierkegaard himself is concerned, one feels that the comic, the elevated humorist in and of a religion is going to be less closely associated with its rituals and with its institutional roles than is, say, the cleric of that religion, mm-hmm. is the daily or weekly officiant at the rituals. We all know what this contrast, and I'm sure we can all joke about it. Of course, the exception which immediately comes to mind to most of us would probably be the Anglican bishop, who probably believes deep belief in God as being a very lower middle class approach to things altogether. But accepting possibly the Anglican religion, which conceivably has a lot of humor built into it, normally one would say the more institutionalized believer is the less humorous, mm-hmm. and the more humorous believer is that who is distanced from the ritual aspect, right. of the religion.
That really does connect very nicely to Kierkegaard's life. His oldest brother became a bishop of the Lutheran Church in northern Jutland, and was very much a man of the institution, a hymn writer, a functionary in the church who was ponderously serious in everything that he did. And here was Kierkegaard, who from a very early age, in fact, who was the subversive outsider, who challenged institutions, who tested the limits. And at the end of his life, when he lay paralyzed in the hospital, and his closest friend, who was a Lutheran pastor, came and offered him communion there, he wouldn't have anything to do with it. He wanted to break with the institutional church.
This is Kierkegaard.
Yeah. He was not attending church in the last year of his life, and in fact launched an assault, a very humorous assault on the Danish Lutheran Church, But the reason he launched the assault was because he thought that the Danish Lutheran Church was profaning the name of God. There's a rather vivid statement that he wrote in some broadsides that he published in the last year of his life. In one of them, he said, "I call upon you, my fellow Danes, not to attend church. Because if you don't attend church, then when you die and stand before your Maker, you'll have one less sin against your soul, and that not a small one. Namely, you will not have been involved in the public making a mockery of God." So he was so critical of the institution that he saw it as parallel to what upset so many Muslims about the Danish cartoons, that it was a profaning of that which was actually holy. So I think Kierkegaard could, in fact, understand the rage that that came through on the part of the of so many Muslims. The difference is when he became enraged, he used humor as his weapon to fight back. The pastor whom he rebuffed asked him, "Do you still hope for an afterlife?" And he said, "Absolutely." So this fits so well with what Paul was saying. There was a deep belief and commitment to the Christian faith, but it was one that, it was new wine that couldn't stay in those old wineskins, I think. He just didn't believe that the institutional church did any sort of justice to...
The institution to versus a very personalized, intense religion.
Mm-hmm.
A religion without rituals and institution, would it still be a religion?
That's a complex thing to know. Kierkegaard died at age 42. And one wonders where he would have headed. This is where it gets a bit comic. There's a Catholic writer who said that Kierkegaard was on his way to becoming a Catholic, that that's where he would have wound up. Whereas members, there's another writer on Kierkegaard who belongs to the extreme left wing of the Protestant Reformation, the Brethren, who said, oh, you know, Kierkegaard was really on his way to sectarian, extreme, sort of Anabaptist style religion. So the people who read Kierkegaard don't quite know where to know where he was going with all that sort of thing.
There are so many aspects to your paper. There's another aspect I'd like to turn to, but before asking a question about connectedness and the way connectedness works in any epistemology and how emotions may be part of connectedness, I just... What do I say? I want to invite you to explore a little bit more closely the articulation of playfulness and seriousness, because the examples were brought up in the discussion. The horror, the terrifying quality of religion is best seen in its objectively suicidal manifestations. That is to say, in most religions of which I am aware, you are expected not necessarily to die for your faith, but you are at the least expected to die for your moral beliefs. In other words, you might be expected to sacrifice yourself for others using the Christian paradigm. So that's shocking. In other words, instead of talking about the mysteriousness and the hiddenness and the awesomeness of God, which is one way to approach the whole question of seriousness, one does realize that the religious believer in most faiths of which I am aware is called upon, as it were, to sacrifice him or herself for others. That is to say, to engage in self-destruction, self-immolation. And I'm not sure I can see anything humorous in that. That's the question I'm asking. Okay. The human is small in the light of God. That may have an intrinsically, there may be an intrinsic rumor of laughter in the back of that realization. And that realization can help the person sacrifice themselves. Perhaps this lack of urgency of which you speak as being a component of humor, this laid backness, is precisely what makes it possible for a person to say, okay, you have all my money, you need it.
Mm-hmm.
Or, okay, yes, I will step against the wall and take the shot, etc., etc. But it's normally cast by in literature, I think, as well as in philosophy, as being the supremely serious moment. Mm-hmm. For example, the end of the Graham Greene, The Power and the Glory. It's very difficult to see Graham Greene saying that that final existential statement by the whiskey priest, you know, when he raises his arms as he is shot, as being other than serious, as being non-humorous. Could you just say a word or two more about either what Kierkegaard might have said about this articulation or how you think it plays itself out?
First, it certainly is the case that Kierkegaard accentuates throughout his writings that element of resignation in religion, the giving up that which is dear to oneself. And I think that's why he emphasized the Abraham-Isaac moment so much, where Abraham was called by God to give up precisely that which was most dear to himself, and precisely that in which the entire meaning of his life was located. Remember the covenant into which God has entered with Abraham promises Abraham will be the father of a great nation. He will be blessed in subsequent generations. So this is the whole hope that Abraham has. And then he's asked by God to sacrifice precisely that. So you've certainly got that moment of deep. I like the phrase that Merrill Westfall, a very good American Kierkegaard scholar, has used, self-transcendence, where I rise above the normal structure of motivation in which I'm an ego seeking its own satisfaction. That the characteristic religious moment is getting beyond that paradigm of self-seeking. That would tie in, I would imagine, to your discussion of the gift, that the gift to be a genuine gift escapes the logic of financial transactions where I'm looking to get something back in turn. So there are people who are finding the 20th century discussions of the gift already there in the Kierkegaardian discussion of resignation. Where humor comes in is Kierkegaard says, yes, I'm called upon to surrender everything that is most dear to myself. And then that act of surrender really becomes not a great meritorious action on my part, but nonetheless laughably small still. So you're called upon to do the great thing, but to recognize that it's not such a great thing in a real sense. It is I think there is what he would call a dialectical structure to it, that it's not something that lends itself to description in univocal language there. So
I see here a distinction between laughing at the act and laughing at oneself. That is to say, the act may be great, but the self is not. In a sense, the humor is directed at oneself rather than against the act. One is committed to do the act.
Mm-hmm. But can I give a North Carolina example? I spent a number of years in the U.S. state of North Carolina. Do any of you know the short story writer O. Henry? Originally from North Carolina, he has a famous story called The Gift of the Magi, in which there are a poverty-stricken husband and wife who are daunted by the fact that Christmas is approaching, and they don't have any money to buy a Christmas present for the other. And what they wind up doing is each surrenders that which is dearest to herself or himself. She's very proud of her long hair. He's very proud of his pocket watch. What he does is he goes and sells his pocket watch to get her some beautiful combs for her hair. She cuts her hair off and sells it to wig makers to buy him a fob for his watch. So they're here at Christmas and they present an utterly useless gift to each other. So you've got this simultaneous moment of it being an ultimate act of giving, where each of them surrendered that which was dearest to him or herself. And it did no good to the one to whom the gift was given. But that didn't matter, because it was the act of surrender that was significant, as opposed to the genuine benefit conveyed to the party there. So I think Kierkegaard would have read that story and liked it quite a lot. That there's this humorous revocation of the grand act, the heroic act that was carried out, becomes funny because it doesn't really accomplish anything, but that's okay. You know, that the fact that the act of self-transcendence doesn't accomplish anything doesn't take anything at all away from it.
Very short, quick question. Would you attach any importance to Kierkegaard's use of pseudonyms in his writings on humor, seriousness, earnestness, and so on?
Mm-hmm. It certainly makes it difficult to know precisely what he thought. He wasn't very interested in us knowing precisely what he thought, but that already puts us into the domain of humor. I like that question. When I teach Kierkegaard, I often say that he's a lot like the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland, that as you try and figure out what Kierkegaard thinks, he disappears and all that's left behind is the smile. That there are all of these books that we work our way through and then they just sort of disappear under us. He forecloses the option of saying, I believe this because this authority, Kierkegaard, said so. Because the books are oddly self-contradictory or oddly self-revoking in a variety of ways. And he used what he calls indirect communication and the structure of the pseudonyms to hide in those ways. I think the way in which he hides in the pseudonyms is already an intensely humorous approach to philosophy. When you think about the ordinary philosophy professor, I mean, we come into the classroom with furrowed brow, with thick, big books, and try in our look and our dress and our demeanor to convey to students that this is deeply serious business that we're about. And there's a sort of directness that goes with that and heaviness that goes with that. Kierkegaard never was a professor. He wouldn't fit into the academic establishment. And, you know, I don't think you can get credit toward tenure for pseudonymous writings. So the pseudonyms are part of his whimsicality.
I'd like to get back to something you mentioned, Paul, about, you know, there's nothing humorous about, so to speak, self-sacrifice, which most men moral value. But perhaps you could interpret that as, you know, being able to laugh at, to find humorous, that your life isn't that special in the world, that you know, that there's something bigger and all this. That's a kind of benefit. It gives you a kind of freedom. It takes you away from the burden of, you know, worry and stuff. So, I mean, I know it's kind of fitting in the logic of, you know, you're giving up one thing and you're going to get something else, kind of this logic of exchange. But perhaps that's one way of reading this, reading humor, that it liberates you.
It all fits into a pattern of thought, which would say that the person who sees himself without being prepared to admit it as seriously religious, precisely because he is non-religious, he acts the religion rather than thinking the religion, is in danger of falling to the trap of taking themselves extremely seriously. Yes, I can see that. May I just slightly divert into another channel of what you were saying? Because earlier on you had outlined, and this may be another way of looking at the whole question of the articulation of humor and seriousness, you had outlined mood's place in philosophy, the place of mood in philosophy. I thought that was very interesting because I believe it's true that emotion has been underrepresented in various disciplines vis-a-vis cognition. It's really, I think, rather recently that anthropology, for example, has begun to pay much more attention to emotion than it did in the past. But when we look at epistemology and how we come to know, it does strike me that one needs more work on this. Anthropology is following in the footsteps, I think, of philosophical work by Foucault in trying to look more at the way the body apprehends rather than knowledge being discursive, worded, verbal, proceeding from axiom to conclusion. So I think this is a very interesting area of exploration. It sets a kind of frame to some of the things you said. I do believe one could argue that quite a bit of our knowledge of the social world or the external world is through the emotional contact. And it is certainly true in anthropology that reflexivity and an emphasis on a much more reflexive appreciation of one's knowledge of other cultures or other peoples or just the people one researches who, in one's own country, has to involve self, a sense of self. And this can seem like navel-gazing. The critique which is always made against reflexive approaches is that it is a form of navel-gazing, which, as it were, cuts the writer off from trying to verify or guarantee the truth value of their statements. They become immersed in themselves. On the other hand, it does strike me as being, as it were, true, and certainly increasingly interesting that knowing other people is a whole framework of connectedness, and therefore the mood whereby one knows is as important as the worded statements one makes about that. So the limit to discourse one of the limits to discourse may be emotion.
I think Heidegger is the great 20th century figure who followed up on this Kierkegaardian lead that mood is fundamentally significant. There's tremendous amount of rich material in Heidegger developing that, including, I believe, in some lectures from the 20s, about 150-page analysis of the mood of boredom. I've often wondered what it would be like to assign a 150-page text on boredom to my students. That's right.
George, I think we all want to thank you very much for an extremely, extremely interesting, clear, and diverse, variegated paper, which leaves us a lot to think about. I, for one, would like to see your papers, more of your papers. I hope to read more of your papers and more of your work on Kierkegaard. So thank you very much indeed.
Thanks.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series. The talk was entitled Humor and Pluralism, Kierkegaard on Religious Diversity, and was delivered by Professor George Connell.